Welcome to another episode of our podcast, Up on Foil, where we talk about and talk to people who enjoy being on foil. And I'm Matt, living in Switzerland.
I'm Gael, living in Cyprus, and we have a guest today.
Yes, the third one is Doge, and he's live with me. He lives in Bern too, which is awesome. And even though he's relatively new to wind foiling, he's pretty good already. He's done some exceptional things, like he crossed the English Channel on a wing foil. He got second place last Sunday at the Wing Foil Cup in Saint Blaise. He participated in the Defi Wind, right?
Yeah, Defi Wing with Defi with a G at the end, not a D.
But thank you. And he's gonna help us and getting to know him. He's gonna talk about his passion. And is there something important I forgot?
No, I mean it was a very nice get to know you again because we saw each other probably more than 15 years ago. Like Optimist, 29er, sailing, yeah. and at the time, probably not as engaged as now. So, yeah, it's quite nice that you...
story. I want to hear this story. How come that you met 15 years ago?
It's a small community, I think.
Right? Yes, exactly. Yes. Sailing in Switzerland is not that big. It's getting bigger, though,
I think. Yeah, or I mean, let's say the racing community is still very small. A lot of people know each other, or they at least know who is who.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And you sailed Optimist. That's actually my first question. How do you get into water sport? Because it's not trivial in Switzerland. There are not many people. There are more people in football and all the other sports, but not in water sports. How did you get into water sports?
Well, it's interesting that in Switzerland, like the educational system kind of helps you that in summer when there's long vacations, they help you find sports when you're very young. When I was like 8 or 9, I don't know, it's even primary school, I think, in Switzerland. Yeah. So the schools help you get into different sports and you can try from the whole breadth of sports. And I chose sailing really by chance. My father can sail and did a lot of sailing offshore. But otherwise, yeah, it was kind of a new thing I wanted to try and I got instantly addicted to it. Or I started to learn to sail on the Swiss lakes and progressively I got into competition. And after the Optimist, I joined the laser class first, where I got into the national youth squad. And that, yeah, just further stirred my competitive nature, I think, in sailing. And then I moved towards team sports, trying 29er and 420. And eventually, after about 1 year in the 470, I did some knuckle sailing.
Yeah.
And then team match racing.
Yeah. All right.
That was, I think, always, or at some point, I noticed that the team sports is really cool in sailing, because otherwise you're always in a one or two handed or two person boat. And so that was during my studies, I did mat racing, and that was for me really nice because I got the opportunity to sail with a really high profile skipper. And we went to races abroad a lot. Like for me, it was the first time I sailed in America was with the mat race team in California.
So that who were you sailing with?
With Eric Monin.
Oh, right.
Yes.
So he's a really good match race. He's probably the best.
He was number one in the world, even. And which is quite a feat because, I mean, match racing is the sports of the America's Cup. So you have really the big shots of sailing there. And for me, it was really an apprenticeship to like learn from him. And
that was
because at that level of the sport, it's really an experience game. And to see that in action and learn kind of the ropes was really a privilege and I enjoyed it a lot. However, then with like the work getting into life, I basically, and then COVID, I almost stopped fully sailing for about 4 years. So between 2018 and 2022, I think I've been once on a lake a year max. So I was really not doing anything but some short helping out in some J70 sailing or like the local sailing community. And then like after COVID, or I think even during COVID, I noticed this wing foiling videos as we were all sitting at home at on YouTube. So at that point I was like, okay, yeah, one day I have to do that. And kind of I pushed that back and back. And then I think October 2022, I went to Lake Como with my family, and the local school there, the sailing school, they kind of offered wing foiling.
Okay.
And the first time I went out with like a huge windsurf board.
Oh, yeah,
so not even a foiling thing, and just like maneuvering the wing, etc. And I think that was good because, I mean, basically as a sailor, you know where the wind comes from and you get to feel the pressure, like how do you transfer the power. And that was an interesting kind of discovery. And I think a month later I said, now I buy a beginner's gear. And then in spring 2023, I really started to go more often. So,
but that's, yeah, as I said, relatively new. But when you saw these guys wing foiling, do you immediately think I want to do that too? Because when I saw them first, I thought, well, that looks stupid. That's like a cheap Decathlon windsurfer. Who in their right mind would ever do that?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's because I didn't watch the people on the lake, but I was watching the YouTube videos. It all looked like so easy and amazing, right? So I literally also when I got my gear, and I got my gear, I think, in January or February. It was too cold. I think went to the lake for the first time in April or something, or March, maybe April. And then I was literally looking at YouTube videos how to do it. I think that was my go-to thing. I was like not really looking at other people. I was like looking at YouTube and then trying to figure it out myself. Until there is a Swiss foiling tour, which I participated in for the first time. I think it was in May.
Was that organized by Grigel?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We had him on the podcast in the last episode. So if you missed that, go check that out.
And yeah, he's an amazing guy to put together this tour. And it's really open to anyone, which I think is amazing. So you get there and you can connect with that community of really experienced wing foilers, including the pioneers of the field, like Vals Müller and Michi Neff, who are there to inspire the younger guys and the next generation to enter wing foiling and that. So that was summer last year. And
so that's crazy. Yeah. So you're wing foiled for a little more than 1 year, really.
Yeah.
That's not a lot.
But I did it quite intensively. I tried to go whenever there was wind, which was about once a week in Switzerland. So I did it weekly. Like after work, and I think that was the way to do it, because if you make two big gaps between your sessions, you forget what are the things you should focus on. So I was like, yeah, and I was like taking notes also to follow my progress. So I was trying to take a bit of a structured approach, but yeah, I mean, it took me at least like 3 or 4 sessions of about 3 hours to even start, like
to start foiling.
Yeah, I think I was struggling a lot with the balance at the beginning, okay, until I figured out that you need to stand almost like with your weight of the shoulders relaxed on top of the foil, and it's not about like leaning back, because you do this intuitive like leaning against the force, but it's actually the force that pulls you up, and you should try to be centered, rested, like almost with the same weight.
Yeah.
Especially when you start with beginner's gear, you can do that. Once you go to smaller foils, you have to engage more kind of with power from the legs and really pump the wing. But for like the beginner's balance, I think that's the key to look into.
Yeah, I think that's a, it is normal if you're coming from like windsurfing, sailing or kitesurfing, that you're leaning probably too much backwards. They're not trusting the foil enough. And I think that I have got kind of like the opposite problem because I also got into wing foiling, not as intensively as you, but I've got kind of like the opposite problem. I don't even remember that I have the wing to lean on. So what tips you wish you had? I mean, yeah, what things you wish you knew when you just started? So what tips would you give to a complete beginner that is just getting into wing foiling? Maybe is transitioning from pump foiling to wing foiling.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting differentiation. If you already pump foil, it's, I think, very different than if you are a complete beginner. And probably makes also a difference if you come from a background where you have some wind sports experience. So, I mean, I already had that wind sports experience. So for me, that wasn't really an issue, understanding kind of reading the wind. Because you can also like exhaust yourself very quickly if you're like trying to get on the foil, but clearly if you look at the wind, it's not going to happen. Yeah. So it's better, like you have to conserve a bit your energy if you want to do long sessions and get the most out of your sessions. But let's say what you asked me, what I would have wished to have known or do differently. I think it would have been helpful to, instead of like trying to figure out by myself and with YouTube, basically how you engage the foil, like for example, when you want to start skidding the foil, like kind of this movement, I think that would have helped maybe to have earlier talked with people who've done it
and so like to get show, a coach.
Yeah. To get a coach that shows you how to move your body basically. I mean, you can watch YouTube. For me, fortunately, it was quite okay. I mean, I was just getting into those videos and like scavenging everything I could find.
Who did you watch? Who helped you the most?
Gwen.
Yeah, probably Gwen, actually. Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. They have a really good channel.
They explain it very well. Plus, it's so... they're so cool. They're so relaxed, and it's great to watch. Even though even if you're not winging, it's great to watch.
No, it's content. True. It's true.
So getting a coach, that would be the first thing.
Yeah,
and I can imagine the gear as well. Maybe Gal, you can tell him what gear you have, and then you, Dohe, can tell me if that's good.
Yeah,
or not.
Of course, exactly. The gear I think can be a huge problem for people, but that's what I like researched plenty. Okay. That's why I didn't order my gear immediately. I was like searching for a month, like what gear before, because I mean, it was going to be winter. So I knew it's not going to be like, I need to find the right gear. And then
what did you write then?
So I started with an inflatable, because I knew at the beginning, you're going to bump into stuff and it's probably not worth. And I think that was really the right decision in hindsight. I think there I was lucky to take that decision because especially as I progressed relatively fast, I was able to get to other boards.
Yeah.
So I think it depends what your objective is. But right? I knew from the beginning. No, so what's important for me was I knew I wanted to do this to do racing.
Okay.
So for all me, right, it was never about I want to do freestyle or only do wave riding. So for me, it was always like, if I do this, I would love to do it again a bit competitively because I saw there was like a circuit for that. And, I mean, I'm not anywhere near that goal, but I know there is a progression towards that if I kind of train properly. And yes, and I made a mess here.
I'm sorry. How big was your board and what's your weight?
Yeah, so my weight is about 80 kilos. And I knew that you need to do like 30 at least. And I think it's 30 plus liters of your weight. And I think that's being very ambitious. I mean, if you have like huge balance, like you're do slackline for half an hour and stuff like that, then you can probably
go as an athlete. So
yeah, exactly. If you already have pump foiling experience, you can do maybe 30 liters, but I think it's not worth it essentially. So what I would actually, in hindsight, I could have even avoided buying an inflatable. I think I could have borrowed it from someone,
because just for the first few sessions,
yeah, and especially if you bought, if you basically in Switzerland, if I would start now, I would just go to these Swiss foiling tour
events,
because the community is amazing there. So they first, when you go and meet them, you talk with them, you get like a first-hand experience live, and you can ask all your questions, even about what gear to buy. Yeah. But they are really kind, everyone. And I mean, even myself, and like, just now when I see people who want to test my gear, yeah, of course, I was able to test from other people in the community, so I also borrow my gear. And that gives you really good sense, because you can compare relatively quickly different things, because it might also be depending on your physique, like the length of your arms, the length of your leg. It really can be a bit of a change between the different gear. Of course, it should be beginner's gear. So as I said, weight plus 40 liters is a good start.
Do you have to get one of these wide boards, or are the long, narrow ones advanced already?
Yeah, but that's exactly something you can test, right? You can do either long and short, or wide and shorter.
Yeah.
So you can play around with that, with the same surface area or liters, and then one thing might be easier for you than...
Okay.
For me, for example, I was... This spring, I was helping a person who had struggled to get on the foil. I tried his board, and it was a huge board. And it was like 160 liter.
Wow.
And I was actually struggling again to bring that. She was like, can you try it if I put the mast in the right position?
Yeah.
So like in the middle of the lake. So I gave him my gear. I took his gear and I was trying to get up.
Yeah.
And I was like, actually, it's not so easy anymore if you're used to doing small gear to have a huge board. And it was quite a wide board. It's like at least a meter wide.
You need a lot of weight for that.
Yeah, yeah. So you need to accelerate it quite a long time. But I think as a real beginner, that's probably actually not so to go a bit too big. I don't think you can go too big actually, unless you're 60 kilo and you take a 160 liter board. That's too much. Okay. But I think if you're a guy between 70 and 90 kilos, it doesn't matter if you take 120 or 150 or even 160 as a beginner, because I think the foil matters even more, I would say, that there you don't go too small on the foil. And there are foils with very different shapes that change a lot, kind of the stability of your flight, which you could say is also a different stage. So this first stage being, well, I can go straight and come back without. I mean, there are different stages until you get to actually foiling. But once you foil, of course, the foil is, I would say, even more important.
Before we move onto foils, I'm curious about boards, because you mentioned that you would suggest something 30 liters above your weight in kilograms. Would you make a differentiation between inflatable boards and solid boards? Because I think that, I mean, I got an inflatable board, so it was probably not the best choice, also because it's only about 15 liters more than my weight, and I struggled a lot with the equilibrium. And you also mentioned about equilibrium left and right and front and back. And I was struggling with front and back. I was sinking the nose too much. So that's something that we should keep in mind. For example, maybe if someone has experienced foiling, like he's a pump foiler, then maybe the balance is not an issue left and right, but maybe the weight distribution between front and back, it is when you have a wing in your hands. Maybe that's something that people should keep in mind. And my question is actually, if the board, we should also consider like the shape of the board, not only length and width, but also how the rails are. Because I think that with these, the problem with these inflatable boards is that the rails are very rounded. So I think that doesn't help with equilibrium.
I've just tested last Sunday. I tested an inflatable hype, the long narrow one, and my rigid one. And the inflatable one had like 30 liters more than the rigid one. And it was super easy to get out with the inflatable one. And there's this myth that if you touch the water, it breaks immediately, or it gets glued to water. Didn't happen at all. And to get out, it was actually easier. Not maybe it was a bit due to the length, but also because when your foil moves due to waves or disturbances underwater, it doesn't translate directly to your to yourself through the board. So it's this smoother ride, actually. Now, when I wanted to tack and carve a little more, then the board didn't go the way I wanted. Should have probably trained more or just get used to that. But getting out of the water, even with those rails, it was actually easier.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really have much experience except that I bought a downwind board. And I was using it, I think, now 4 times for winging.
Yeah. How long is it?
It's the 100 liter. Yeah. So it's less than my initial. So I can give you my wingboard history. So I started with 120 liter F1 yeah. inflatable. Then I went down to an 80 liter Fanatic, now Duotone,
mm-hmm.
Which basically that was a mistake. I was like wrong because I tried it and then tried also other boards yeah. Because I was getting into this community and I was like, I felt not really great on that board. And then I went down to a sinker board. So for me, that was like a first kind of a
so that's that step. You shouldn't have taken.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, or I basically sold that one immediately afterwards. And for me, the decisive question is how far do you want to learn something on a board,
yeah.
right? For me, the inflatable was getting up,
yeah.
riding steadily in down direction.
Yeah.
And I think I was able to have like 90% of my jibes.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, now I move on.
All right.
So I moved on quite quickly. Right? I was not trying to do tacks with the inflatable.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe for fun
a few
months later. But
yeah.
but basically I sold that setup quite rapidly. That's why I think I could have probably went with borrowing and finding gear and actually comparing much more gear.
Yeah.
I think now I have had 2-3 sinkers actually. And so, with the sinker boards there, I mean, once you do really all the maneuvers, etc., like tacking there, and you start to change the foil,
yeah.
I think then it gets much more, yeah, you go into more detailed things. But
so
I think for a beginner, I think an inflatable with plus, I would say not 30, but 40 liters. And then, I mean, that's why if you try it and you feel already super unstable on it, just standing, I think you should go for more liters. I think that's the, and I'm not so sure the shape of the board. I mean, I know it makes a difference because yeah. I have this downwind board, which is like round.
Oh, really?
Right. So sure. Standing on that is much more tricky than mm-hmm. I thought it is. Than if you have a flat. So I've tried now flat and round
mm-hmm.
downwind boards. Of course, the flat one is way more stable.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit what you need to test yourself if you want to have if you're more feeling more stable in the longitudinal yeah. axis or the
that's a pitch, right?
Yeah, exactly. If you're yeah. more pitch stable while just standing on the board,
yeah.
then you may want to have a bit of a wider one if you're struggling there. And I think that's something you just probably best test if you can.
Do you have a wide one, Val?
It is quite wide. I would say, yeah, it is quite wide, but it is short. It's only 5 foot.
Mm.
So yeah, that's probably short. Why it was tricky for me to
yeah
to understand the pitch. Yeah.
And was it in when you were powered with the wing or without?
Yeah, I was powered with the wing, yeah. That's probably another thing that I wanted to ask you, and maybe you want to share with who's listening. What wing would you recommend at the beginning? Because I was starting with a very, very big wing because I wanted to be overpowered, but that's probably not the way to do that, right? Because you have such a massive wing in your hands and you don't really know how to handle it, and then you touch the water and then you touch the foil and just a mess, right? So just probably better to go with something smaller in bigger conditions. Am I right?
Yes, you're right. And that if you actually you asked me before what I would have done differently, or a lot of people were basically when I went to these events, these community events, people were laughing at my huge wing. I started with an 8 meter. So you cannot.
Wow.
But so when I did my research, I was like, okay, I want to really go once a week in Switzerland, which is like you want to be out there in 8 to 10 knots. So I actually went out in 8 to 10 knots just to like maneuver the wing. And like for me, it was, I think, maybe not the best choice. Because again, I could have probably borrowed an 8 meter if I was feeling...
There are not many guys who have an 8 meter though.
No, but I've seen people now with 7 and 8 meters. I mean, yeah. 8 is maybe the extreme, but you could have... I think 7 meters is good. If you go out in 10 knots or 15 knots with a 4, 5 or 4, you're not going to fly, right? If you're a beginner. So I think being overpowered as a beginner... is a good thing, and you need to also learn how like to depower the wing once you're up. So I think I wouldn't say it's such a big mistake to go too big, but again, I think it's something you best are able to kind of borrow gear before you settle on the size that you feel is good for your area, right? If you go out always in 30 knots
or don't get that 8 meter wing.
Yeah, exactly. If you or you're in an area like where there is like Lake Garda, you know, there's always like 15 to 25 knots. You're going to be buying a different setup.
But there again, you said that it's probably better to get out with more wind and a smaller wing. Yes, but there are also going to be more waves, and that's going to be so much more difficult. I think the waves, if you're not used to them, that's the hardest part.
Yes, I agree. Because in what conditions were you out when you were feeling... You said you were nose unstable.
Here... It is kind of choppy, I cannot compare. We cannot compare the sea to a lake. Yeah. Even though it's not ocean, still we've got a bit of chop when it's windy. Yeah,
that makes it so much more difficult.
First time I was on the sea with the wing, I was kind of overdoing it because there were huge waves. When I like last summer, I like could barely jibe on the Swiss lake, and I was like, okay, now I go to the sea. And I went to like Gran Canaria in 35 knots.
Oh wow. Yeah.
And it was really, that's where I learned like, okay, now you need to learn how to ride waves. Because before, but there is also, this is a transition, right? When you go from, okay, you can fly straight, you can jibe, you can change your foot, then that's already good.
Yeah.
But then you're still not, if you're not used to waves, that's kind of the next step, I would say. Like, if you make your list of what should learn in which order, I think there is a list of what, because there's no point in learning.
Let's do that list real quick.
Well, I think
first the wing handling.
Yeah, exactly. Wing handling on the land, and they're really the YouTube channel of what is it, Damien and Gwen. It's really good.
But they always say learn on the beach. That exactly. I don't agree, because I think you should learn on a skateboard. Because
I mean,
walking with the wing
is
terrible.
No, this is true.
Or standing with the wing, because it behaves differently. If you move a little bit on a steady surface, like a skateboard.
I mean, first statically on land, then skateboard. You can walk also with the wing, right? So static, with walking with the wing, skateboarding with the wing, and then go on the lake when it's flat water and light winds. Try to go back and forth without, how do you say?
Without going on foil. Just taxiing.
Yeah, without going on foil and trying to maintain kind of the upwind position without going too far downwind, right? And having to walk back too far. That's already kind of, that's quite advanced already if you manage to do that, and then go out in more and more wind, because this is true. So if you have a smaller wing, it will feel much easier in stronger winds to kind of depower and handle it. So this I think is a good point, but you need to have a big enough wing to get up on the foil, and a big enough foil to get up. And once you do that, you I think learn well to power, depower, and then I think jibing is the obvious thing you should learn. Otherwise, you never get back to where you came from. So doing that, and I think for me the biggest thing was, I think jibing, it took me a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, it took me a month maybe to learn jibing. And there, I think there's many interesting videos, like with your foot position, you get already a bit of a feel for the foil. I think in the sense of having the foil in an unpowered wing position, because for me that was a bit, I think, the problem. I for a long time I was still, even when foiling, I was holding the wing in a way that once I didn't have the wing powered anymore and would start to turn, I would fall immediately. Okay. Like for me, the jibe, I was like,
did you all over the place. Foot switch first or after the jibe?
I learned to do foot switch after. Yeah.
Because the foot switch, I think, is more difficult than just the jibe. And once you're over, then you quickly foot switch and then you're back on your comfortable side, which is probably heel side, right?
True. I think probably heel side jibes are, and I mean, now I just change foot before the jibe.
You do that before the jibe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Always. Because I think the turn itself is more stable.
And you can do it quicker as well.
Exactly. But I think what's quite difficult is to do, if you're learning, to do the foot switch while you're winging. I think it's the, I mean, I don't know, for me, I feel it felt like quite difficult to do. And it's still, I think, I have a harder time to foot switch before the maneuver for a reason. I think it's easier after the maneuver.
Yeah, me too.
It's like, I don't know, maybe it's psychological.
I have this exact same thing, except for the tacks. For me, it's easier to first foot switch and then tack.
Interesting. Yeah.
Then do it the other way around, because I'm not super flexible. Yes, I know, girl, you have this video on stretching and I should really watch that and do that thing, but...
You're always pitching my videos. I should pitch yours as well.
But that's how I learned, man. That's how I learned.
You're going too technical here. I want to know something more. Like you mentioned at the beginning, probably off camera, that you're getting into downwind foiling. And I want to hear your thoughts about that, because I think that downwind is becoming probably the biggest part of foiling. Am I wrong? So what are your thoughts? Like, in your opinion, is downwinding taking away something from wing foiling? How do you see it? And how do you see the transition between wing foiling and downwinding? SUP, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think the transition is... I mean, it's difficult to say I don't master downwinding. I mean, I did pump foiling and then going down in the waves. So I think it counts almost like downwinding, right? If you're just staying on the wave with the pump foil, but I mean, nowhere near the size of the foils that I've been using for just riding the waves. I think the smallest wing I've used for just waves for like a half a minute or a minute. But I mean, it's also a question of how long you manage to stay up without falling down, is with like an 800 square centimeter
foil. Yeah, right? That's so small for me. I ride big, big front wings. And the wing you rode on this wing foil cup there, that was what, 700?
500. That's crazy. 530. But that, I think that's the, I think that's why, I mean, to get back to your question, what it takes away from wing foiling, I think for me, it's a challenge to learn another discipline. And like, I started pump foiling this winter. That was for me just a natural extension of wing foiling, because in wing foiling, you can technically just put the wing on your hand and do whatever the other discipline is. You can do pump, you can pump, or you can go in the waves. So I did that, I mean, or started really doing this end of last year on the wing foil. And I noticed, okay, maybe it makes sense also to learn pump foiling just to perfect technique of pumping.
Yeah.
And downwinding is perfecting your technique more, I think, of reading the waves. So I think depending of whether you start with pumping or winging, downwinging just seems like to be the next level thing to do once you are comfortable in either of those disciplines. And now for me, it was wing foiling, pumping, and now downwinding. But you can do pumping, winging, downwinding. I don't know if you go from pumping to just downwinding. You can, but the winging is a very easy way to get into waves and learn how to surf waves. I think because you, instead of a paddle, you use the wing to get into the waves. And I'm not sure the paddling is easier. I mean, if you come from SUP background, yes.
Then probably. But I see the problem I see is that when you do this downwinder with the paddle, there is wind. So you could also go winging. So you're not going to go wing because... And that's where I see the problem. So the next time I want to try this downwind foiling with the paddle, it's going to be on a day that I could go winging.
And that's
true. That's true. That's what I think he meant with taking away from winging. Yes, in terms of time on the water, it's a choice you got to take for sure. But nowadays you can go winging in any, I mean.
Yes, you can wing in 5-6 knots.
Yes, exactly. So with the new gear, if you use a downwind board to wing, which I think is also a micro step from, that's why I got a wing downwind board already, is to just get used to the size. I mean, I took a small size, too small maybe. I have a 100-liter board, which will be tricky. Or I mean, I managed to paddle it up against the current of the Aare.
Oh yeah, but, in a knot.
Yeah, but. Nice. But it's, I think on the lake, it's going to be much tougher. And in the waves anyway, it's going to be quite unstable to learn to downwind on that. So for me, it was good to get used to the board with winging. I think, well, ask me again in a year if that was the right call. But I think downwinding, I would say, is the master, I would say the master discipline, because it's the most difficult to learn from everyone.
And you can use a cheat, like a little para wing.
Yeah, the para wing. Foil drive, true. Yeah, probably the foil drive, I mean, from all the people I've heard, the foil drive is probably a good way to actually learn it more quickly. Because I think you will, if you're out with the paddle and you don't get up, it's not like you can, I mean, it's a pain. Right, because you cannot really paddle back up wind, so you have to do your run anyway, but you're not foiling, so you're losing a lot of time. I think managing the time and distance management becomes even that needs to be dialed in, because if you want to progress quickly, if you are willing to waste afternoons just paddling down the lake or the sea without getting on the foil, then it's going to be tough, but you can do that. I think getting like the distance properly at the beginning, that's the key there to unlock. And so I did with my pump foil, I think I managed to do like a kilometer. But even if I go out paddle this winter for my first downwinder, I think I will not take much more than a kilometer, right? Because if you don't manage to do that, just swimming.
Yeah, I thought maybe, or that will be my goal for this winter, to just take the length of the Lake Neuchâtel, which is what, 30 kilometers?
Yeah.
And just start at the windward side and see if I manage to master it while going down.
Yeah, but I think that's like after one winter. I think the first sessions you're happy to do like 1 kilometer, then.
Yeah, but you have to go back. And as the longer you go, the bigger the waves are. So maybe it's easier to get up.
No? Yeah, but I think that's it depends which wind direction Lake Neuchâtel. But I think if there is bees, you better get further down at the lake in where there are.
Yeah, you start in Neuchâtel, or the other way around, you start in Estavayer.
Yes. So you do shorter runs. That's what I mean. Like the whole distance is just too much.
It's still going to be 15 kilometers. Anyway, you said you did pump foiling as well, and that's where I actually learned from Gael with his journey.
Yeah,
have you seen his videos too?
Yes.
I was saying that we can say that pump foiling is kind of like the gym for professional runners. Like at some point, I think that if you want to progress into wing foiling, zone winding especially, you need to practice pump foiling, especially also like prone foiling. So that's also the reason why you got into pump foiling. So tell us how you got into pump foiling. How did you find the transition between wing and pump?
I would say because my winging technique was not, I mean, last winter, I think there's a huge gap between now and winter. I feel like progressed so much before I got into, I think pump foiling really helped me. I mean, I was really fascinated by the GWA, which has kind of this winging, and then you do one section of the track.
Yeah,
you cool. have to
free fly, right?
Free fly, yeah. And put the wing on neutral. So I wanted to do that, and I knew that you need to also be able to do it on quite small foils. So I knew that you, because otherwise you're not fast enough. And that's why I knew, okay, if you really want to get your level up, you need to, well, master pump foiling. And so started with a huge wing to just be able to do it. And then I started to use my wing foil.
So you pump foil with your 500? No.
No, no. But you, the ping, the, you, when you free fly with the wind, yeah, it works, all right? Right? But it, I mean, I would say the real first challenge was this spring when I went to the GWA event in Lecot. That was the first time I had to basically do in the competition the free fly. And there I like had a 50-50 of making the, I don't know, few hundred meter free fly run.
Is that a few hundred meters?
Yeah,
it looks a lot shorter on video.
No, but I mean, I think last year they did once like a 500 meter one, wow, in Gran Canaria, which was, but there you had huge waves.
Yeah.
And in Lecot it was
flat.
It was flat. So I think it was maybe, 180, 200, 250 meters. But it's still long, right? So that was for me the first time where I noticed, okay, without pumping, I would not, if I didn't learn pumping, I would not have made it.
But because you were at this GWA event. How did that go? I mean, was this your first event like that?
Yeah, so I was lucky to get kind of a free card. I mean, I did one event before in Gran Canaria.
Yeah.
Kind of a qualifier. But I was, I think, second to last or third to last, but still they invited me to go. So I think that was really cool to basically learn from the other riders, to see them. I mean, you see videos, but it's not the same, yeah, if you can talk with them and learn about kind of the small details, right? So that was really cool. We had also like 55 knots of wind. So
55, jeez.
I think I was slightly overwhelmed by that part, besides having to race. Now it's really that's like, it blew my mind. It's impressive. Like in those conditions, it was, I think, even for that, for like the pros, it was up on the limit.
From the wind.
Yeah. But still they were out in like 3 or sometimes even 3.5 or 4 meters because it's not a full upwind. So yeah, we have like a reach,
yeah,
and then you do a triangle.
Yeah.
And then you have again reaches before the free fly section, mm-hmm, and then the finish also reach. So you, most of the time you're reaching.
Okay.
Except a short
time where triangle, you get triangle.
And the triangle is probably where some people maybe misjudge the wing size.
Yeah.
Because on the reach you can take half a size or even a full size, okay, bigger if you have the power,
yeah,
to hold the wing, and then you go faster, essentially. If you take a too small wing, you cannot fully power up. And then some people like fell or had problems in the triangle. You
when is it going upwind?
Yeah, yeah. Or you could see that some people, like small things, like if you have a wobble on the foil or if you're not like tacking high enough and you get too low,
yeah,
or touch down, then people just pass you, right? So that's why there you see like, okay, you don't need to only have 100% in your foiling jibe or tack, but it has to be a high foiling, yeah, jibe and, okay, a high foiling tack to be fast. But that, yeah, so you get to start to think about how to improve and train in those details. And I think that was for me a great experience.
And that was one year after you started wing foiling, yeah, essentially.
I noticed that in May, I was like, okay, I was in Silvaplana for the European Championship. And I noticed like a year ago when I was there for the Swiss foiling tour, I couldn't jibe, or like I had like 50% of my jibe. So that was, I did quite a good progression. And that's why I knew and I need to start to work on the details, let's say, of all the maneuvers.
Yeah, and the maneuvers, the tacks and jibes, they're just 100%.
Almost. And it's good that you ask, because so this spring they started using double skins,
yeah,
and basically the first time I took a double skin, I was like, I can't foil anymore.
You know, like, what a double skin is, Kyle?
Yeah, with it's like the wing with the double
profile.
And the profile is not nicer. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So you have no turbulence behind the wing, but the turbulence is what makes you the wing stay neutral.
Yeah.
So it's much more tricky.
There's because no neutral wing.
Yeah, there is no more neutral wing. It's just a wing that pulls you forward. And so in the maneuver, I mean, for going straight, it's amazing because it's very stable. Yeah. If you find the right locked in position. So that for me again was kind of a learning. Just I was like, okay, now I can barely wing in all conditions, like from 55 knots down to maybe 10. Some of the pros can even wing in 5 or like bulls in 2 knots, right? But if you can wing in the 10 to 55 knots, you can do tacks, jibes, then and free fly in the waves. Then I was like, okay, new wing, and I can't foil anymore. What's going on? So again, you kind of learn how to deal with that. And I haven't, even by now, I would say not so much time on the water with the new wings. And I have basically still like improved the percentages of the success, tacks and jibes. And because also there's a huge difference, right? How quickly do you change your foot after the tack? And this was what I noticed in Lökkert, basically talking with the guys, how they do the foot step at the same time as they change the hand and things like this, right? So you start to work on kind of the speed and almost the subconscious, how you can do it without thinking, right? So that you can actually look at other competitors and I mean, they're super close. Like sometimes you're, so I the first time I took a start with the other guys, I was like, they were just so close, and the line is relatively short. Yeah. The first time you're like almost scared to go too fast, right? Because you're so close to each other. But it's super adrenaline and super fun. So can't wait to get back on the starting line. Yeah. But admittedly, these GWA kind of reach starts, they are kind of I would say the most risky out there.
What speed is he right then?
I mean, I don't have the GPS numbers of the fastest guys, but when I was looking at my GPS at like 27, 28, not 28 knots, the others were still going faster. So I think they're going like at 30 plus on those reaches.
That's crazy. That's 60 kilometers an hour, more or less.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And they do it like the thing is, do it consistently without falling. Right?
And 2 meters next to the other
guy.
Yeah,
exactly. So, I mean, I don't know if you guys maybe know from Italy, that Ali Tomasi is one of the big guys from Italy in the game. Yeah. And like I witnessed from shore how he crashed.
He did the world record, right?
Yeah, he has one of those record runs. Yeah. And I was like watching how he crashed with a French guy at the first mark. It just looks just scary looking at it, right? And imagine being in one of those crashes.
Or just behind them.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So I think it also tests your like reactivity not to fall into someone who is falling. But if you look at also like the windsurfing PWA events, it just some stuff just looks... I mean, the whole foiling discipline has probably brought a risk factor for sure. And I mean, we're talking about safety gear before. Yeah. For sure is a big thing to.
So you all wear helmets, probably goggles. Yeah. I saw with special like speed goggles.
Yeah, I was surprised no one else was wearing sunglasses. And I think in kitesurfing they do use kind of almost ski glasses.
All right.
But I'm surprised that it hasn't caught on in wing foiling racing yet. But I've tested them for the first time last weekend. It was the first time I was using them. So I'm probably going to keep them. It's interesting when you like fall in the water, you have like the water here and it like slowly sinks and you see again, because the first time when you're in the water, you don't see anything.
It fills up with water.
Yeah, it fills up. It's not like swimming goggles. Yeah.
And talking about foils, what foil did you start with? Was it the right one, or you would recommend something else? And then what was your progression?
Yeah, I think, and I only think I learned this a bit more recently, is there are very different beginner foils. I don't think I paid too much attention at which shape but at the surface area. And many people say, yeah, if the surface area is the most important thing, but I think the shape also matters, because I think there are some foils out there that might look cool, but they're probably not the easiest in terms of stability. So I think if you have like a foil that's shaped like this, it will help you a lot in this roll stability. And so if you take a too flat big foil, you're still going to struggle a lot with stability, even if you pop out maybe earlier because you had a better glide.
And also the thickness is important.
Yeah.
It's everything. And there's so many brands. It's
yeah, really it's so difficult to choose. Get an overview. But again, there, I think you need to test a lot before maybe buying a setup. Or and maybe you can even, yeah, rent through the beginner phase.
What brand do you ride?
I had a F1, a 2200 square centimeters. And I think it was good. I mean, I was quite happy with that choice. I mean, I mean, it took me a bit at the beginning, but I think it was overall a good choice from what I've heard from others.
And now you have what?
At the moment, my quiver is not that big anymore. I've sold a few foils. So I had, at the moment, I have a pump foil, 1900 from F1. So I stayed with F1 for the pump foil. And I probably will also for the downwind use F1. I had an Eagle as my second foil. That was quite a step. So I did like from 2200 down to 1000. That was, I think, that's why I learned to do the jibes on that.
And then I went, the difference is insane. It's like half.
Yeah, and then I went to Gran Canaria in the waves in 35 knots with this 1000 foil, and I was like, oh my god, it's harder than I thought,
because it was too big.
It was, first of all, it was too big for that wind, I think, because I think you can size down quite a lot if you go in strong winds. Yeah. I mean, if you need to be stable on the foil. But I was underestimating the Eagle, actually, even if it was the older edition. There is now a new downwind edition, which I think looks very good. I've seen it this weekend. It has an immense glide. So if you're in the waves and you're not used to that, that basically the waves pushing you, it feels... You're like, what's going on here, right? It's magic happening. So if I wouldn't recommend this to the... I mean, I wouldn't... for me, it was okay because I learned on the flat lakes to use the Eagle, and then it was really efficient to get started. But if you're in a bit of choppy area, there are better foils to go maybe from 2200 down to 1600.
If you have these choppy conditions, the foil, the how it looks, how is it different? It's less shaped like a mountain, if you will, but more the other way around, or what's the difference?
I've never seen a foil
completely other way. Well, it's not completely like that, but it's at the end, the tips, they're going up.
Yeah, the tips, I mean, so the Eagle is like basically flat, and then how the tips, it goes up, but this is, I think, just for efficiency. And then I've heard that some people cut it for whatever reason. Probably you can turn better if you cut the tips.
You said right, is the tips is like the same as the planes for turbulences. So it theoretically, the little tips up make the foil more efficient. But again, many people cut them because then probably you lose a carving.
Turnability.
Yeah.
I think that's a trade-off to make. You want to go into the waves. Are you winging to do only flat water winging? You want to do speed. I mean, you can do different things, right? Freestyle, for example. I, from the beginning, said I'm too old for this stuff.
How old are you?
No, I'm not too old, but I'm 30. But I was like, when I see the young guns with like 14, 15 years old, they go up like 8-9 meters and bam.
Yeah, but Paul's also 30, but he's exceptional.
Yeah, yeah, but of course, but he's used to also falling. So I think
that's true.
So like you fall in a proper way. And if you look at the young guys who just send it, I mean, sometimes they fall in a way where like my body wouldn't survive this, right? But they just get up and go again. So I'm like, okay, if I mean, I do now a bit like jumping, but that's just for fun, and you actually need it for racing. Talking of the defi,
because the sausage, they want to introduce the sausage as well.
No, maybe sausage in the GWA. Yeah. I don't know if it's a topic these days. In the PWA, they have that, which I think is interesting. But for the defi wing, it's basically a lot of
algae. Seaweed.
Seaweed. So. No. For seaweed, you need to be able to jump.
If you to get rid of the seaweed that it's on your foot. Oh.
Because if you don't jump, you basically have to slow down and then kind of get started again. So I learned this the hard way, because in the defi, I wasn't able to jump. So, I try to jump, and you have to learn to jump, let's say, like this, and jump efficiently.
Let me ask you, because you said that you need a lot of time. You have a little less time now to practice, but you do crazy stuff. Like when you cross the English Channel, I mean, let me just hear that story, because I read about it on this website, but that's a crazy adventure.
Exactly. We want to know how you got the idea, and like, were you followed by a team? Because I honestly don't know how you did that challenge, kind of, if you will. So tell us how it was.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit it was a bit of a crazy. So it's not like for me just another Sunday stroll on the lake, for sure. Because, I mean, there are multiple things here to consider, but I can just give the short story is that I know Jo Wiebel, which is the guy who organized this. He did last year for the first time this fundraiser for, he owns a foiling school
on the Lake
Uri.
Yeah,
exactly. And he was in Brazil together with Balz, and they did kind of this fundraising for the Duchenne disease. So it's a disease where muscular dystrophy for children, especially boys. And they did kind of a charity run, which usually takes place in Switzerland. They went for a charity foil.
All right.
And they did a charity foil run in Brazil. And he wanted to repeat that this year. And he contacted me because he wanted to do it in Germany. There is an island there in the northern part of Germany next to Denmark. I think it's a Danish island, Finn. And he wanted to do the round this island trip, and I asked him why not another area, why particularly this island, and he said because there is a regatta there for sailors. But when he asked them if the foilers are allowed, they actually said the foilers can't participate.
Oh, all right.
For I don't know whatever pride reasons they have. So I asked him why do we have to limit ourselves to that island, or can we just look at the forecast and maybe do something else? And then I think we were brainstorming, and I suggested, why not the channel? And I really just threw it out there. I had no idea how he would react, because I know he has done other projects which are really impressive. I mean, if you know Franck Camas from France, he's a offshore sailor and a multiple offshore races he has won, and he went with him around Cape Horn in catamaran. And he holds, I think, the 24-hour record on a 20-foot catamaran that he did with Costa, you know, Costa, the offshore sailor, another Swiss.
Simon Costa. Yes. Used to sail against
Him. They won. They had like the fastest the longest distance in offshore sailing with a catamaran.
Yeah,
like
a small one, but like a super small.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a beach thing, and crossing the sea with that is also kind of
so. How spectacular! What's the distance of the English Channel where you?
So originally we wanted to do the crossing in Cherbourg to the Needles, which is opposite on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
So that would have been the original objective. Because of course it's also on the French side, as the English side is quite famous.
Yeah.
But it's quite a distance.
What's the distance?
So that would have been about 90 nautical miles.
Wow.
So that's quite long. So we planned to
170 kilometers.
Yeah, exactly. So we knew that if we have like a 15 to 20 knot average, you would still need like 10 hours if you basically do without breaks. So we planned to do that.
You wanted to go there and back. You didn't want just one. So it's 180 nautical miles that you wanted to.
No, I think that's the back and forth distance. That's
both ways are 90. All right. Oh.
No, that's the back and forth distance. And eventually, when we went there, we wanted to do it on a Saturday, so we would have had the whole day, but there was no wind. And we also, as you may have read in the blog post, we also had issues with the boat.
Yeah, your safety boat.
Safety boat. So that was a big factor. And so for me, it was the first time really doing offshore. I mean, I've never been offshore actually. Yeah. It was the first time I was offshore really in a dinghy.
How long was the race and how much it took you?
Yeah, so it was a race against time because we did it on a Sunday and people needed to be back at work on Monday. So, and we were in the northern part of France, so we had quite a drive back with the van. And so we had a time window. We got up at 6 a.m. In Dunkirk. So it's I think 2 hours or 1.5 hour first leg from Dunkirk to Calais. And Calais is the point of the shortest distance to England. And there it's 39 nautical miles.
One way or there and back again?
I think it's one way.
Yeah, I think. All right.
Yeah.
So with an average of 20 knots, you'd have 2 hours to get there.
Yeah, exactly. So in theory, it sounds not very far. That's the point.
if you never fall.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in the end, some of the learnings are like looking at the map is like one thing, but you need to calculate in current, you need to calculate in the wave state.
Seaweed, I read.
Yeah, we had seaweed. So, I mean, there is many things I think that we, in hindsight, know now. Like, if you have like the time schedule, you need to put in buffers, because it's very ambitious to just go there, basically like a weekend trip, which in the end was what we did. Because we had Yo, we were very well like prepared in terms of safety.
Yeah.
But still there are some unknowns that we had to deal with on site, like the safety boat. The one we wanted to rent didn't turn out to be good enough to be able to fill the tank.
So the tank gasoline. Was too small. Exactly. Oh no, you can pull it.
Yeah, so we knew that probably the tank might be not enough. So we knew that we needed to bring spare fuel. I mean, we found out the tank site on site, but we knew that could be a risk. So we had like prepared for that, but still filling up the tank with sea state. If the tank is not easily accessible, it's quite difficult to do. And we had only one person on the safety boat. So I think in the future, like probably having two people on the safety boat would be good. First, we wanted to also bring someone who takes photographs, but that didn't work out. So having two people on the safety boat, I think, is a highly recommend for redundancy and also for our safety boat driver, which is huge respects and to him, because without him, it would have been just impossible. Because
plus, if something happens to him, there's nothing he can do. If you fall, eventually there's going to be wind, you're going to continue, but he cannot continue.
Exactly. The motor. So the motorboat, we ended up noticing that it's a bit of a liability. Yeah, he said that in some big waves, and we had big waves, the boat wasn't suitable. So it's something not to be neglected for sure. And I think in hindsight, that was probably the riskiest part of the whole adventure was the
the safety boat.
The choice of the safety boat, we underestimated it.
So how long did it take you to go there and back again? Not these 4 hours?
No, exactly. So because we did a part along the coast of France from Dunkirk to Calais, And we also used the opportunity to do a small photo session before the crossing. So we, I think, left at 6, were in Calais around 8:30, and then left at around 9:30. And we had like an hour and a half, because around 11:15-ish, we were already close to the other side.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't enter the English coastal area because we were not sure if our boat was allowed to do that.
Okay.
Because we had heard from the other rental situation that we had the day before that the boat wasn't actually allowed.
So don't go there.
Yeah, exactly. So we were like, okay, maybe we shouldn't risk it to be dealing with the Royal Navy or whatever, right? So we decided to do a photo session on the other side, and then we decided it was about time to get back because we needed to be back in the car by 6 p.m. and
go back to work.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I think it was a great, because it was a charity thing, I think it drew attention to both those aspects, right? I mean, we're trying to gather people for a good cause, and at the same time it was also a personal challenge and experience to grow with.
That's perfect. And I think it's also inspiring for like other people. Like, I think that these challenges are becoming more and more popular. I've seen like these two guys crossing the Greek islands. So yeah, I think that with these new technologies, I think that many opportunities are opening up. And to wrap it up, what would you recommend like to beginners or to people who want to get into these challenges that you just made?
So for me, wingfoiling, I've started with the motivation to do it kind of competitively for racing, because it just looked amazing to race with this very special gear. And so for me, that was a huge personal ambition challenge to learn how to do it, first of all, and then kind of push the speed limit. The first time I went over 30 knots, I was like over the moon, because it's like, it just the speed and adrenaline that you get is just amazing. But besides that performance side that can be pushed infinitely, I think, or is just there's a lot of room to the top, I think it's just I'm starting now to discover that you can do so many amazing things. You can discover new places, because wingfoiling is not like owning a boat. It's much more convenient. You can pack it.
You came by train to the last event.
Yeah, exactly. I came to the last event. I went with public transportation in Switzerland. So technically there is no limit there. And I think the gear is getting much better, safer, and more accessible for everyone. And I think that I've also seen a little bit now, I don't have the whole big picture like other people who are in this for much longer than me, but the community grows. I mean, the competition we did last week and last year, there was half as many participants, and now it's doubled, and you get to know really other passionate people, and you exchange a lot, you learn a lot, and you just have a lot of fun.
Super friendly people.
Yeah. And it's just fun, and you get to have a good time outdoors, which is very difficult in some others areas. It's like that there is such a vibrant community who gets together enjoying outdoor sports in this way.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that was guys, it. What do you think, Kyle? Do you have anything else?
Thank you very much, guys, for being up, and thank you very much, Dohe, is it correct?
Yes.
for being here, because it was pretty helpful, I think, for people listening, like learning about these wingfoil tips and learning about your trip, your challenge. And I think that we're gonna see them in the next episode, right? Which is gonna be about?
The next episode is going to be with Cody Eisenhut. He's a wing foiler, also tried some pump foiling. He used to be a professional kite foiler.
He's actually a para winger too, so he's gonna maybe talk us through the wings and the feeling of flying. That's gonna be the next one.
Cool.
I think that's pretty cool. Well,
sounds exciting.
So yeah, we'll see in the next episode.
You know what? Right. We're gonna link your website, the one where you did Channel Crossing, in the comments. And looking forward to the next one.
Yeah.
See you. Bye bye.